Usually when we speak with Anthony Shadid, he's in Beirut, where he's bureau chief for the New York Times, or in Libya, where he was one of four journalists captured and held for 6 days by Muammar Gaddafi's forces. Recently, we spoke with Anthony at Porter Square Books here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Anthony had written an article for the literary journal Granta's issue marking 9/11, a story about the elite high school Baghdad College, founded in 1931 by New England Jesuits in a golden era of U.S.-Iraqi relations. The students said the school helped them be better Muslims. Boston's cardinal wasn't happy. I loved the quote you have from Cardinal Cushing. "This mission has to be the biggest waste of money and manpower in the history of the Catholic Church. Not a single convert from Islam." But Baghdad College closed in the late 60s after the Ba'athist coup. U.S.-Iraqi relations have, of course, changed, as has the once glorious Baghdad College. We began by asking Anthony Shadid to read a description from a recent visit.
"Baghdad College welcome you," the sign reads along a street that is ordinary, but only if you live in Baghdad. Nothing really escapes the detritus of death in this wreck of a city. Certainly not the cement barriers along this wayward street, painted yellow and white, but more distinguished by the chisel of war, of wear, tear, and bombings. The date trees are unharvested, fruit shriveled by the sun falling into a pyre of overgrown weeds, a dusty black banner mourning two Iraqi soldiers killed in the line of duty, stretches along its curb, plowed with bottles of Tuborg beer, plastic bags, some of them snared in barbed wire, and empty packages of Foster Clark's corn flour."
Anthony Shadid, is Baghdad, is Iraq repairable? What's your sense?
When I left in January of this year, I guess I was overwhelmed with this sense of a society that's been wrecked. Can it repair itself in a generation and 20 years? And you know, I think it probably can. I mean, I don't want to be that pessimistic to that degree, but it is amazing to me to see how torn the fabric of that society is. I think what Baghdad College represented and what's been lost, and what's been lost in the Arab world in general, that sense of cosmopolitanism, that sense of a secular ideal, that sense of identity that can be universal and not hew to these smaller notions of ethnicity or sect or history, for that matter, these identities we create. I think getting back to those notions is very difficult, and I think in Iraq it's even more difficult.
And the Ba'athists were partly responsible for this.
Absolutely.
When they came in 68, I think, and started driving the divisions that hadn't been there before. But what do you say to people who say, yes, but despite the Baghdad you paint, the Iraq War paved the way for the Arab Spring?
I mean, I think it delayed the Arab Spring, if anything. I think 9/11, I think the invasion of Iraq, all these things delayed what was inevitable in a lot of ways. And I have to say, I was so deeply pessimistic for so many years. In fact, you know, a friend came and said, "You seemed really down last time I heard you speak at Harvard Law School." I have to say, I'm an incredible optimist right now. I think things are headed in the right direction. And I feel almost naive in saying that. I feel kind of like a little kid. Mm-hmm. But what I've witnessed over this past year, I think, is so exhilarating and so inspiring. And it's going to be bloody. It's going to be very grim in the short term and the medium term. You know, but finally, you know, a narrative is being written in the Arab world about the Arab world, and it's being written by the Arab world, and that's something remarkable. And Iraq never got to have that. Iraq never got to write its own narrative. It was you know, a play that, you know, took place on, it was grand theater, you know, and the Americans orchestrated that, I think, in a lot of respects. Iraq is going to have its own spring, I think, or it's going to, you know, be a frustrated and divided society that's never going to live up to the ambitions it has for itself.
Do you think that spring is going to continue in Syria?
I think Syria is going to be the tough one. And I tell you, Syria is one that's very, you know, I hate to say this because it sounds maybe callous, and I don't mean to be callous, but intellectually it's a fascinating story to try to report. And of course, you know, I was able to get into Syria a couple of times, but we've had to largely report that from afar. Syria to me is the hope and the danger of the Arab Spring. When we talk about these broader identities, these ideas of being citizens, that we have rights that are due to us simply by being a citizen, by being part of a body politic, Syria has the potential to do that. I think Syria has it's such a sophisticated place, it's such a rich place in terms of its culture, its history, the talent of its people, the solidarities that have been coming together, I think, since the revolt began in March. we have to remember, this is a country where Damascus and Aleppo have contested for supremacy for years and years. People used to dismiss Deraa in the south as hillbillies. Homs and Hama often competed. What you've seen during this revolt are these remarkable solidarities coming together where people are protesting in Homs for the sake of Hama, for the sake of Deraa-Zur, for the sake of Deraa. These divisions that have haunted the country for so long have not divided it yet. This idea of being Alawite, a heterodox Muslim sect, being Christian, being Sunni Muslim. If the government fell today, I think this country would come together in a beautiful, remarkable way. My fear is that the longer the government stays in place, the less chance they have to overcome these divisions that still do haunt that country.
And isn't it the concern, you know, which way will they go when they get to that fork if it takes too long, Egypt or Libya,
right,
picking
right.
up arms as they did in Libya?
And I think, you know, if you look, if there isn't something, and I don't think it's imminent, I mean, but I also didn't think Tripoli was imminent. You know, I think the longer this goes on, I think it's just almost inevitable that it's going to become more violent. It is going to get radicalized. You know, I hung out with the youth there, and they've passed the point of no return. They're not going to give up. But what do you do as the killing goes on and on and on? When do you lose patience? And I think it is a matter of time before patience is lost.
You know, you say you hung out with the youth there, and I remembered your recent article. And that's what I love about your writing. You're sitting with some young people in Baghdad. I think they might be the new Baghdad college students. And you're sitting with them, and they're all sorts of, you know, cynical and everything. And a car bomb goes off, and you jump, and they don't even blink.
That was just amazing. I couldn't believe it. I'll never forget that. See, it was a college of fine arts. And I was talking to them about kind of this collision, you know, this American-Iraqi collision and what the detritus of that collision was. It's a very nice conversation, and then you're exactly right. A car bomb went off down the street, maybe 100 meters, 150 meters away. I forget how many people died that day. And I was flinched, and they started laughing at me. And I they didn't put that part about the laughing at me, but I don't think they blinked. They may have, but it was such a window on how traumatized that country is in some ways. I mean, you even to this day, you cannot meet anyone in Baghdad who does not have a relative or friend killed or wounded. And when you think about that everyone knows someone who has paid for that conflict, it's a remarkable statement when you think about it.